Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Mays, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Pudge Kleinkopf, and she'll be answering your most important questions on moving from rookie to novice to pro. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Pudge a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future shows. Just go to our homepage, put in your name, your email address, and we'll keep you informed about all our future shows. The broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc. doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Pudge Kleinkopf about moving from rookie to novice to pro. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I've ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kick boats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at their ultimate personal flotation crafts. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. That's bigskyinflatables.com. Before we introduce Pudge, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Pudge's section that says, "Click here to register for our drawing." Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Pudge's book, Rookie No More, courtesy of Pudge Kleinkopf. So here's how you can win Pudge's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is be about something that Pudge and I talk about during the show. So you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, type fast, and maybe you'll be the proud winner of Pudge's book, Rookie No More. Our guest tonight is Pudge Kleinkopf. Cecilia Pudge Kleinkopf is a retired university professor and lawyer, a longtime fly fisher, and has owned and operated women's fly fishing for 30 years. She offers lodge-based fly fishing schools and small group guided trips throughout Alaska for salmon, trout, grayling, char, and pike. She also leads saltwater fly fishing trips to Mexico each year and offers a fly fishing school in conjunction with the John Campbell Folk School in North Carolina. Pudge took the winning sailfish in the 2005 Sails and Tails Fly Fishing Tournament in Zihuatanejo, Mexico. She serves on the pro staff of Mustad, Ross Reels, and Patagonia. She's a regular presenter and fly tire outdoor shows in Alaska, California, and Washington. She's been featured in the Anchorage Daily News as one of the special explorers for Alaska's magazine television series on PBS. And she's a board member of the International Women's Fly Fishers. Pudge is the author of Fly Fishing Women Explore Alaska, River Girls, Fly Fishing for Young Women, as well as Fly Fishing for Alaska Arctic Grayling, and her most recent Pacific Salmon Flies, as well as her most recent book, Rookie No More. She also serves as a contributing editor for Fish Alaska magazine and serves as an elite pro for Sage and Pro Patagonia. Pudge, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Oh, I'm great. I'm excited to be back, and thanks very much for inviting me.
Yeah, well, it's fun to have you, as always, and You're quite the prolific writer, that's for sure. You must love writing, huh?
Well, you know, I kind of, when I got started, both of my first two books were Benjamin Franklin Award winners, and so I thought, well, maybe I ought to keep doing this. So I have for a while. Yep. So now I have five. Rookie is five.
Well, tell us before we get started with the questions, why you wrote Rookie No More? Where did this come from?
Well, several years ago, I was affiliated with a big website called Fly Fisher Pro, believe it or not. And I did the women's column for them every month. And then once a month, we did a podcast, the fellow who owned the website and I, and we did it on a sort of a question and answer format. Well, after those 4 years, his wife was very ill, and he ended up selling, you know, the website and everything. So he called me up and said, you know that you have now all of this material here, all in your columns, you know, from the podcast. And he said, and you hold the copyright. And I said, yeah, I know. And so he said, if you don't do something with all of this information someday, he said, I'm really going to be upset with you. So I've always had that in the back of my head for the last four or five years, maybe it's not quite that long, but that long, to think that there is a lot of interest in out there in people wanting to know different things about different aspects of fly fishing. So I finally sat down and just put it all together and wrote a book that became, we worried a little bit about the title, but it became, we call it Rookie No More. And then the subtitle is The Fly Fishing Novice Gets Guidance from a Pro. So that's where this newest book number five is now.
Well, certainly you do answer a ton of questions in the book, and that's where we'll base the show tonight and try to answer just a few of them because we don't have time to go through all of them tonight. But let's dive in and see what people have asked here. And, you know, I was thinking about it, you know, after we talked this afternoon, and I don't know who said it or where it came from, but I remember somewhere reading that, you know, to become a pro, to become an expert, you have to invest like 10,000 hours in whatever you're doing. And at that point, you've had enough experience and enough exposure to be called a pro. Do you think that's what it takes in fly fishing as well?
No, I
not
I think,
that long.
Not that long. Golly, I wouldn't be here. I don't know if that was that long. Well, now I would because of all the years that I've been doing what I do.
Yeah.
No, I think it takes more determination and willingness to, you know, go through the hard steps to keep going. I think it's more that than it is, you know, counting hours.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the questions that came in is, you know, if I'm a beginning fly fisher, what's the best way for me to start learning?
Well, you really need to take a class. And many people say to me, men and women, you know, I don't have a class here. You know, there is no class being offered anywhere here. And so I urge them to, you know, contact their local or the regional fly shop. Or, like now, community colleges are beginning to offer fly fishing classes. Or, if they simply can't find one, then many people don't even know about Trout Unlimited and the International Federation of Fly Fishers. Both of those really national, international organizations have programs, you know, on their own schedule, but that offer classes for getting people started into the sport of fly fishing. So it may take a little digging for somebody to look around, but you know, get on the internet and see if there's anybody near you. But just because people say, well, I picked up a fly rod and I just can't fish, you know, fish with it, and I always am caught in the tree, and you know, I don't know how to what to do, and so it really is, if you want to start fly fishing, to just kind of get yourself into a class. You don't usually have to buy any equipment or spend a whole lot of money to take a class, but it's really pretty the best basic way to start.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, that's not the way I started.
No, me either.
I think my great uncle said, here, and handed me this case with a bamboo fly rod in it. And so then I thought, well, I'm going to have to get a reel for this. So I went out and got one of those automatic fly reels. You remember the one?
Mm-hmm.
You press
mm-hmm.
the button and it reels.
The zingers. That's what we called it, was the zingers.
Yeah, that was my first outfit, and then I just went in the yard and start flailing, you know, and
mm-hmm.
somehow got the hang of it over time. But another way that I think, and one way that I learned is from a mentor. That's why I learned how to tie flies. There was a guy that, a father on our block, I was in like junior high school, I went over to his place, and my buddy went there, and he would teach us how to tie flies. And I think there's a lot of people that would love to mentor you, too, if you're in a spot where you can't get a class.
Well, and that's getting less and less. There's more and more classes everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the mentor is someone you want sort of, I think, more after you've kind of learned, you know, what the heck is a fly cast and, you know, how do you tie on a fly, because mentors are already, I remember when my son was trying to teach my now daughter-in-law, and he said, Mom, I forgot what it's like to be a beginner.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I got her started. But there are, you know, a lot of ways. Some people do it and can do it effectively watching YouTube videos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not very many. I mean, people say, and then I go out and try and do it, and I can't.
And I think you have to have, like you say, that basic knowledge first to be able to learn from videos. And also, just like you mentioned, the FFF, Federation of Fly Fishers, I know when the first time that I was going down to do, you know, saltwater fly fishing, I hired, you know, one of their instructors just to teach me about casting in the wind and, you know, double hauling. And, and you know, it was probably the hour most well spent that I've ever spent with, you know, with learning fly fishing, because he was all focused on me at the time, too.
Right.
And
right.
showing, you know, seeing what I don't see or I don't feel. And it was well worth the time and the money to do that. So I think, you know, when we talk about moving from rookie to novice to pro, there's always a chance to learn more.
Oh, always. The one thing I love about fly fishing is there's always something to learn. You will never learn it all. And that's, I love that. It's called a thinking person sport, and I like to think about it and just, what's new and what else do I want to do and how can I perfect my cast and all of that. I love this other saying that fly fishing is the sport for the rest of your life.
Yeah, yeah, I would say that's true.
And it's certainly been true for me.
Yeah, yeah, me as well. So what, you know, if a person is going to take a class, what are the basic casts they need to know to be effective on the water, you know, whether it's a stream or a lake or...
Okay, well, when you start, if to take a class, you want to ask the instructor some questions. You want to know that you're going to learn there's three basic fly casts that you should know when you end up, you come out of a class. And one of them is what we just generally call the overhead cast. That's the kind of back and forth cast that you see people casting with on the beach. Then there's a cast that's called a roll cast. That is a cast that's very useful so that you have a cast that you can use so that you don't always end up with your fly in the tree behind you if you don't know any cast but the first cast. So that's the roll cast. And then the third cast is what's called a sidearm cast. And that's the kind of basic cast that you're going to use to get under, let's say, a dead tree that's hanging over a little bunch of trout, or in the wind. So those three, the overhead cast, the roll cast, and the sidearm cast, are the three that should be taught in the class that you're going to take.
And when you said sidearm, it makes sense to go under the trees and stuff. Why is that something you want to learn for wind?
Because if you look at all these pictures of wind and, you know, how winds go and what they do, there's always this, unless it's a hurricane, of course, there's always this space between sort of the bottom strength of the, you know, what's the wind is doing between that and the ground. So the closer and lower you can get toward the ground and stay up off the water, you end up able usually to get under the wind. And then you don't have to cast right into the wind.
Mm-hmm. Very important in the salt water
situation. Yes, very much, yes.
Yeah, because you're always facing some kind of breeze out there. Mm-hmm. And when you're not, you're hot as
you're hot as heck, yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, it's like no wind.
Yeah.
No wind situation, you know. So.
No wind at all, yeah. In saltwater fishing, you pretty much go from one extreme to the other.
Yeah. So I had mentioned taking classes from a FFF instructor because they're certified and so forth. What are the other ways that one could become a better caster? What do you have to do?
Well, I think the world of YouTubes has helped create better casters in many, many instances. I mean, there's lots and lots, more all the time, of, you know, YouTube videos, and some of them are just really, you know, not what you need. But there's many of them on there that will say, you know, let's look at your, see how you can improve your cast. And there's many of those can really be helpful. So it's kind of when you're getting into that, now I want to be a better caster and I want to improve my cast and whatnot. There's also two things you always want to work on doing. And one is you've got to practice. You can't go, I have clients frequently who say, I go fishing once a year and it's with you. And then we have to almost always have a little remedial lesson about, no, this is kind of the way this cast goes to get it out, you know, into where we want to cast. And they don't need that because they're not intelligent or anything else. It's that they have forgotten a lot. Their muscles and their brain has forgotten some of how to make a good cast because they haven't done it for a year. So, you know, I think practice is a big thing. But when you practice, now I learned long ago, and it's really easy to do now, when you practice, video yourself. Get your phone, get a chair, set your phone kind of where it can see you, where you're practicing your cast, and then turn it on while you're practicing. Then when you turn it off, look at it and see if you can critique yourself. And most people can. They'll say, oh, I'm casting too fast. I can see it now. Or, oh, I don't keep my thumb pointed to the sky like I'm supposed to. So that's why my front cast is falling on the ground. Or, you know, I'm not keeping my hand up straight. And so it's a nice little device. So you thought you had everything you needed with your cell phone, but actually it's something I recommend to people now all the time. Go video yourself and then critique yourself. And then
yeah,
you know
I think that's great.
When you want to cast, I mean, get somebody to help you. You want to say, I need to know how to keep my line up off of the back in, you know, when I'm casting. You have something to say to your instructor. Here's what I want you to help me with.
Yeah, that's a great idea, great tip to do that. It's
so
easy with everybody's
works really well.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to do that, you don't even have to have a connection for your phone, you know? I mean, it'll be
right.
Recording even if you're out on the lake or somewhere like that practicing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The other thing that I found helpful is not only practicing on grass, as a lot of people do, but also then switching to the water because of the difference
yes.
in the, you know, the water tension and stuff. And I think
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you agree that you really need to be practicing kind of both places to get the real feel.
Well, you need to, but I think actually you need more to practice, I think, off the water. Then if you're on the water, you want to be fishing. you don't, most people just don't want to, you know, just practice and say, I don't have a fly on and all of that. But you're right. You need both kinds of feel in your rod, in your line, and what's happening when you're casting.
Yeah, yeah. So talking about rods and reels, how does one go about selecting a rod and reel line for the type of fishing they do? Because nowadays we've got everything from panfish to, you know, smallmouth bass, largemouth bass, trout. We've got char. We've
tiger
got pike,
fish. We've got
salmon.
Everything. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're like Jeff Currier, I think he's got 350-some fish on his list now that he's caught on a fly. So
yeah.
Where do you begin?
I was going to say, he better not, because, you know, you haven't got just about so many on your list you can get. He's getting up there.
Yeah, he is.
Well, most novices ask that question, and they should ask that question, because you're not going to use the same rod and reel for a grayling or a panfish that you're going to use for a fish when you're fishing for marlin or Dorado or those kinds of. I want to put a little pug for the rookie book. This is all discussed starts on page 29. I looked them up, some of the questions I thought we'd have. And that helps you to understand how to select the right rod and reel for the type of fishing you want to do. So start with the thought that you're not going to do it all of it, all the time. So think about the fish that you're mostly going to go for. I live in Alaska, so in many cases it's people are going to go salmon fishing, and that's what they want to do. So now you need to know that salmon is a whole lot bigger than a trout usually, so they're going to take a heavier, they're going to need for you to have a heavier both rod and reel in order to fish for them. Because many times I'm on a very, very populated river here in Alaska, and almost every day, every time I go, sometime during the day I hear pop, and it's a rod breaking. And it's a rod breaking. I go down usually and say hello to the people and ask them if I can help. And what I found is they're trying to fish salmon with a 5-weight fly rod or a 6-weight fly rod. Well, if you do that, sometimes you could get by with it, but most of the time you break a rod. So you don't want that to happen. So that's what you want to do with the shop, a fly shop, or there's YouTubes as well. We'll help you to select the right reel for the type of fishing you want to do. Now, as a quick let's over with that, fly rods can be, we talk about generally a 9-foot long fly rod as being the best all around kind of fly rod. Mm-hmm. And it's numbered, and it's numbered based on the fly line that it's able to cast. So it goes from small numbers to big numbers. So if you get a fly rod that is, that you can see it's a 9-foot, it's got a 4-weight or 5-weight on it, those are going to be rods for smaller fish. Now, if you're going to go to the salmon up here in Alaska, or redfish or steelhead, now you got to have a bigger, tougher ensemble. So now you want a rod that's a 9-foot long, but what's called an 8-weight, because it's tougher and stiffer, and it'll hold a bigger line, and it's got a stronger reel to reel the fish in. So then, if you want to go on to the really big stuff, marlin, Dorado, steel, all the big stuff, then you've got to have more rod yet. So you'd have usually more than an 8-weight rod. I fish usually with, sometimes we do 8-weights off the beach, but we go up to what are called 10-weights. So now we're getting a bigger, stronger rod, or there's rods that are 13 and 14 size rods that are custom made. So you just have to get help to the how do I select the right reel and rod for the type of fish I want to do. And so if you're going to do all those things, if you're going to fish in saltwater and you're going to fish big fish like steelhead, and then you're going to fish smaller fish, you're going to need one of every kind of category of rod and reel. That's the bad news.
Well, the fly rod companies are cheering you on there.
But I know they are. but it's true, because you risk you go saltwater fishing with an 8-weight, and you're going to try and fish a – I mean, I have actually had clients with me who have done it, caught a marlin on an 8-weight rod, but it took them 2 hours to do it. Now, you
That's
don't want that.
That's not good for the fish either, right?
No, no, it's terrible for the fish. And they risked their rod.
Yeah.
It's just that it happened. That's all that they had or whatever. So you really have to think about you need to think about what kind of fish are you going to fish for. And here's the other question that almost always comes along with this one is, can I use the same reel with all of the different rods? The answer is no. You need a rod and a reel that go together, that work together to help you to make a cast and to land your fish.
Yeah, and balance the rod too, right?
Yes,
If you have an oversized reel and a small rod, then you're not going to be able to work the rod as well, I wouldn't think either.
And you're going to have the wrong kind of line and the whole, all of that.
Yeah.
So that's...
Well, let's take a quick break. We've kind of run over our break time, so let me jump out for a minute, do a quick break, and we'll come right back and answer more questions. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Pudge Kleinkopf about moving from rookie to novice to pro. If you'd like to ask Pudge a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Pudge, I always ask my guests, what's going on in your fly fishing world at the moment? Tell us a little bit about your business and what you might be doing in the cold winter season of Alaska.
not much.
Not much.
Not much. Since I'm not much of a ice fisher either. I mean, ice fishing is really hard to do with a fly rod because the holes aren't very big and it's hard to get the fish in and out. And when it's cold, the minute the fish is out of the water, I mean, I don't know how many seconds somebody measured it once, the fish is dead. So you can't put it back effectively. So anyway, so what I do this time of year is I write, I market my business, Women's Fly Fishing, our website, if I can do a little promotion, is www.womensflyfishing.net. And I just a couple of days ago posted our 2017 trip dates that are on the website. So you can look and see if you want to come and do a trip with us to Alaska, and or we do a fly fishing school for women only during the course of the summer. So all that's already on our website now. And I'm thinking carefully about another book, too. So that's what I'm doing.
Any hints?
Not yet.
No hints.
Not yet. We'll have to see.
Okay, good. So womensflyfishing.net, and that's where people can go and find out about your upcoming trips and so forth and training. So that's great. That's great.
And also my fly tying. I do fly tying classes in the winter. So I've got one coming up in early December.
Okay, great. Well, thanks. Thanks for sharing. And, So I just got a question in on the Internet since we're talking about books. Rod down in Amarillo, Texas, he says, I want to write a book on fly fishing warm water bass, in parentheses, largemouth, and I've been fishing for them for 40 years and have designed many patterns for warm water species. How do I get started if my writing skill is limited? Any helpful hints for Rod on starting his first book?
Yeah, you know, I get a lot of questions about that. And if you feel like, you know, you really aren't a fairly good writer, then you need to go to a community college and go back and take a writing class. Because there's so many people writing out there now that publishers aren't just going to take people who have, you know, run-on sentences and, you know, other kinds of bad grammar. And editors, there are editors that will almost completely rewrite the book for you, but then it often turns out not to be your book, and it costs you a fortune. So that's kind of, I think, what you want to think about starting to do. The other thing I'd recommend is that you try writing some articles for your fly fishing club. And that way you'll begin to get a little experience, you'll get feedback. And what I always say to, I was a grant writer and taught grant writing in the university here too for all the years I was with them. And I always said to people, ask for feedback. And if you need feedback on things like writing, go see if in your circle of friends you don't have maybe a teacher, an English teacher. And who knows, you might find someone who will help you to edit the stuff that you are beginning to write.
Yeah, so just collaboration. And
jump in. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so Rod may have all the facts and all the knowledge and just can't put it into words, but you see a lot of books where there's collaboration like that. Well, so one has knowledge, one has skills in writing. Yeah, good idea. Okay, there you go, Rod. Couple hints and tips on getting that first book written.
Do some articles before the books. Don't leap in massively to the big stuff. Get yourself feeling comfortable by writing some articles and stuff.
Yeah, and one way or the other, you're going to have somebody look at your work and edit it because whether you hire them or it's a teacher, somebody's got to show you the way, you know, and make
that's
those
right,
corrections
or help you along. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember when I first started writing, I hired an editor, and she went through my work, and she would explain to me what I did wrong. And after a while, I had less and less errors and less and less errors, you know, and it got better and better. Mm-hmm. But it cost me some money to get that editor.
Too.
Yeah,
I've had an editor, and she has been with me for all five of my books.
Oh, wow.
And she's not cheap, but I wouldn't put a pen to paper without her.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Useful
assistant for sure. I got another question from Craig in Portland, Oregon. He says, I consider myself a decent fly fisherman, and I fish about 50 days a year in the West. A few times I've fished in the presence of a few master fly fishers who seem to have an, in quotes here, it factor, as they always catch more fish than others. They aren't embellishing their numbers as I see them catch the fish. What factors make them so much better than others? Is this just innate, like Michael Jordan being able to hit the game-winning shot?
You know, Craig, if you stay 10,000 days a year in the West, there's always going to be somebody who's better than you are. I swear it's ever, I mean, I've been fly fishing now for over 35 years, and I don't know probably half of what there is to know about fly fishing. But my son is one of those it people. Every time I fish with him, I decide that he doesn't go where the fish are. He just stands there and the fish come to him. I swear they do that. I've seen it over and over and over and over. He can walk through a spot where, you know, five people have fished and haven't caught anything, and by the end of that little end of that space, he's got four or five fish to show for it. I mean, there are just some people. Maybe it's their smell or something that the fish like, but there seriously are always people who are going to be better than you. And I envy them too sometimes. But then, since I have accepted the fact that they're out there, then I think, okay, Pudge, just fish. Just fish. just fish. And whatever they do is fine for them. Because remember, there's also, which I hate to say, a whole bunch of people that are probably a lot worse than you are fishing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, they always catch more fish than others. And so think about it as you go fly fishing. Try to think, you know, I don't really do it to get fish. I do it for the enjoyment and for the fun and for the beauty of, you know, where I'm, the river and all of that kind of thing. And I bet you you'll stop noticing so many of these it people. But
yeah.
they're going to be out there, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, you may be able to, I mean, I've always fished next to people like that. There's, like you say, there's always somebody better than you. And sometimes they, like we talked about before, a lot of people have knowledge and can't write. A lot of people have knowledge and can't teach. So even if you ask some of these people, what are they doing different? They can't even explain it, you know.
No, they can't.
But
they can't.
I do believe there is some kind of sixth sense that your son has, mm-hmm. and other people that, I don't know, maybe they just try to set that hook at just a fraction of a second earlier than I do, you know, and they're getting those hookups.
Uh-huh.
But it just seems like there's something going on there.
Well, we were actually having a couple of glasses of wine, a friend of mine, and one night, and we were talking about this very subject, and we were talking about, well, you need to put your time in on the water. You know, maybe they've put up more time in on the water. We all know we're always, you know, we're always learning. But what we finally decided between us was that they're more attuned, they're more alert than we are in some way. Because I remember him saying, and this was way back when I started fly fishing. And he said to me, Pudge, watch your line. And then he didn't say anymore. And I said, this is a fellow that had given me some lessons and some instruction. And he said, the biggest mistake that most people make is they look all around, or they get a swig of beer, or they, you know, talk to their friend, or their, and he said, watch your line. He said, that is, I think, the one mistake that people all make.
Losing focus.
Because of the, you will not, you know, we have to practice that theory a lot up here in Alaska, because sockeye salmon don't grab. They are the one salmon of all the five species that doesn't grab their food, because they were plankton eaters. They just filtered it out of their water. So in order to catch them, you need to never take your eyes off your line and where your line is in the water. Because oftentimes, if you're alert, you'll see or feel this tiny little move, or you'll see it, a little twitch, or you'll see your fly going up the river instead of down the river. All of those are fish. You have a fish on in all of those examples. But you missed it because you weren't paying attention to your line.
Yeah.
And after that, you know, I found that even though I'm still never as good as my son, I'm never going to be as good as my son, but I've learned to watch my line much better. And when I have my clients concentrate on their line, they catch more fish too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the next question is, what are the most important things to keep in mind when nymphing? So we know that watching the line is number one.
That's exactly right. I was just going to say, it's good. And that's nice to have this question, you know, right behind the other one. Yes, that is probably the biggest thing that you need to keep in mind, and that is watch your line. Now, but in this case, you want to watch your line so that you don't have a lot of line downstream of the fly, because then it's pulling your fly. And then it doesn't look right to the nymphs. The other is, you know, you'll get sometimes a little more a little more touch on the fly than you'll get with sockeye salmon. Sockeye salmon are incredibly difficult to fish for, but they're are best to eat, I think. Nymphing, what you have many people have trouble nymphing because they cast their line out too far when they're nymphing.
Ah.
Try to keep a shorter line, and so you keep your nymph moving in front of you so that you're more apt to see the little movements or the hesitations or whatnot that occur. Now, a lot of people fall back on a strike indicator, and many people say, you know, they can't fish without a strike indicator. But you'd be surprised what you can if you have yourself do it and do it. I have a couple that fishes with me a lot, and the first time he fished, he said, oh, I have to have a strike indicator. So I put a strike indicator on, and nobody else was using a strike indicator, and they were catching fish like crazy. And he said, well, can I do that? Well, they fished with me a couple of times before I finally convinced him that he really didn't need an indicator. So we took it off. And ever since then, he's been catching fish like crazy. They fished with me this year, and he took off the indicator. And one day, he was the only person without an indicator. And he caught the most fish. So it's, an indicator is kind of a, it's like a little fallback kind of thing. But, no, I think it takes different concentration to nymph than to dry fly fish, because in dry fly fishing, you can see your fly, you can see the drag, you can see all of that, whereas that all that's happening with your nymph, but you can't see it.
Yeah, yeah.
So
and I think
to
going back
to
what, when you said dry fly, you're also focused on that dry fly. I mean,
you can see
it.
You
don't take your eye off of it. But when you're nymphing, like you said, you're not watching your line half the time, and so you're not focused on it, and you're missing more fish. So, yeah,
and so your nymphing line, your leader should go pretty much straight down.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Good. Let's take a quick break again, and we'll come right back and jump right back into these questions.
Okay.
Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. So learn more about the Housatonic River Outfitters. Go to www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Pudge Kleinkopf about moving from rookie to novice to pro. If you'd like to ask Pudge a question, just go to our homepage, type in your question there in the Q&A text box, then send it to us. We'll try to answer as many of them as possible tonight on the show. Okay, back into the questions. Okay, here's another one dealing with nymphing. When should I use a dry dropper rig instead of a nymphing rig with a strike indicator? What's the difference between those two rigs? Because you see them used, both of them you see used a lot.
Okay, yeah. Well, again, if you go to my book, there's a chapter there on dropping, making droppers and using droppers. And the indicator, you shouldn't just associate. If you're using a dropper, you got to use an indicator. You could do that, but you don't have to.
Right.
And a lot of people think, well, I can't rig up with a dropper because I don't have an indicator on. That's not really necessary. So there's several kinds of droppers that you can make. I learned how to use a dropper in Ireland, 20 years ago, or 25, I don't know, where we were fishing four flies on 1 liter.
Wow.
Yeah. Because they frequently get 2-3 flies on at the same time. And I had never seen, I had seen a dropper. And it had been when in Alaska, we took a little bit of our leader and we tied it, we put on a second fly, and then we tied the leader to the bend of the hook that was coming directly off the leader. And that was the way we did, we did an indicator. So I rigged up my equipment for the day, and I was terribly embarrassed, and I was very happy that no one else was around. My young gilly, which is what they call a guide in Ireland, looked at my equipment and said, "Madam," remember now I'm in Ireland, he said, "Madam, what do you have here?" And I said, "Well, you told me that we were going to fish on a dropper today, so I made a dropper." And then there was just this long period of silence, and he said, "No, madam." He said, "Let me do your rig," he said, "and then later I will teach you how to do a proper dropper. How do you like that?" I loved that. I absolutely loved that. But I was so embarrassed. I said, "Michael, this is all I know how to do. This is the only kind of dropper that I've ever seen. What are you doing?" So that evening after we came in, having caught lots of fish with all of his flies on the dropper, and we were having a I was having a glass of wine. He was having a pint, of course. And he taught me how to make a proper dropper. And a proper dropper in Europe, at least, is 2 to 3 to up, sometimes there are 4 flies that drop off the main leader with, you have to learn how to do a blood knot with this. And so that you can't use a surgeon's knot. It doesn't work because the dropper drive swims along beside the main line and on a just a minute, I lost my train of thought. And on a, what's the other
one? Inline, right? Inline.
Yes.
I mean, you can have the tags there that you can.
Yes, then you, right, that's exactly what I'm trying to say, is that you have the tags there on a blood knot, and you have to learn how to leave one longer than the other, and then you add at the top the more leader, and then that's the ready for the next one. So in the book, I've got about 3 different kinds of, 3 or 4, I think, different kinds of leaders and how you create them with droppers. Now, most places, you can't use more than, like in Alaska, we can't use more than 2 fish on a leader, 2 droppers on a leader. And then even with that, we have to look at the regs to see, you know, if that's legal. But the hopper dropper thing, I mean, whoever created that just gave us all a great little edge on our fly fishing because that gives you a great opportunity to either see, like, which fly, maybe you put 2 droppers on and they're the same fly but different sizes. That'll give you something. Or you've got 2 nymphs on, and one is a golden hair's ear, and the other one's a pheasant tail. And so now all the fish want the pheasant tail. And so that gives you a great opportunity to quickly check 2 flies and see which one is taking the most fish.
Yeah. And that's very helpful, when you're doing searching aspect of things, not knowing what's happening out there. A great way to search is doing the dropper in multiple flies. Yeah, I know, was it Canada? I'm trying to remember. Every state has a different law on
yes.
On what you can and can't use as far as number of flies. So I guess, you know, depending on the state you're in, you're just going to check and see what you can do there. We just had, I got a couple questions coming in here. We'll come back to those in a second. Okay, so next question up. I tried for 40 years to spot fish and still can't despite my polarized glasses. Can you help? Karen Erickson in New Mexico. Join the crowd, Karen. It's not easy to see fish.
It's not easy to see fish. Well, so first, Karen, you need to make sure that the tint that is in your Polaroid glasses is a tint that will and help you to see fish. There's all kinds of, I have the people who come all the time to fish with me and say they've got their Polaroid glasses, and I say, "Now there's those 3 fish you try to fish for," and they'll say, "Where? I can't see them. And it's they have Polaroid glasses. They just don't have the right tint. So there are tints, the professional, polarized glasses people make different tints for different things you're going to use them for. And so in many of the fly shops will have different brands of Polaroid glasses and will show you, they have a little stick behind them so that you can kind of see what you would see if there was really moving water to help you. Because that, I find, is the number one problem that people have is they don't really have a polarization that enables them to see. Now, even with that, I'm not saying you can see all of the fish and whatnot. So the next thing then you have to do is you have to do some reading, read up on how you look through the water in to see if you can see fish there, or how you arrange yourself. Now, there's a section in the book on that as well, and it's I think that one is submitted. I wrote down just thinking people would want some of these. Let's see. It starts on page 95, and it's it helps you to see fish. Now, the other thing so you need to learn is where to look. I mean, if you're looking in the wrong place, you'll never see fish because there aren't any there. So, or it's too deep, and so you would never see the fish because they're down way down on the bottom. Or the river's moving too fast, and so you can't see then. But so in my book, I give you two or three little tips about where are some tips that fish usually are. Now, and they're easy to think. They're almost always on the edges of currents. Fish won't fight a current if they don't have to. Remember, their face is pointing into the current, and so they have to exude a whole lot of energy to get up there. So they go on the sides of when they've got a current coming down. Now, you also can see them if you just carefully stand and wait a while. You can see them under overcut banks, undercut banks. You can see they'll be hanging over there, and waiting for fish to come down. So as I say, if you read kind of that question and answer in the book. The book, by the way, has 40 questions with their answers, and so we may get to some of them tonight. But otherwise, if you don't win the book, you can buy it on my website and then read that particular chapter. So I hope that's helpful a little.
Yeah, and then of course it all changes when you go into the salt water and you have another situation. I was asking, I was just down in Belize and asking my guide for the day, what are you looking for? Tell me what you're looking for,
Mm-hmm.
I can try to see what you're seeing. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he said, because it's a little bit different there, you don't have the current, those hiding places,
right.
The resting
right.
spots to look,
right.
look for the fish. So it's fish coming up on the flats, and he says, I look for a change, something that looks just a little bit different,
mm-hmm.
A little shade of gray that's a little bit different than what I'm used to seeing. And he says, then I just stay on it. I don't
yes.
move my eyes. And he's polling
exactly.
up on a platform. He goes, if I take my eyes off it for a fraction of a second, I'll lose it because there's too much water out there. So I stay and I stay and I see if it moves. I see if it changes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If it does, then I just stay on it and I don't take my eyes off of it.
Right.
But that was his
right.
little trick out in the salt to try to, because you have a lot more space to deal with. But also there's the hallucination factor. I found that after 7 hours out and looking for fish, by the end of the day, every little tip of a wave looks like a fin.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I go, oh, God, am I hallucinating out here or what?
Well, what I tell people when I'm teaching them, because I start a lot of people in dry fly fishing because that's what people want to do because
yeah.
it's so much fun to see, the fish come up and get it.
Right.
But, that's one of the hardest things to accomplish. And so I send them through a little thing and I say, okay, the first thing I was going to put on a fly, and I put on a big fly, and I put on a fly with white wings so they can see it. And I said, now, we're going to cast out. And I give them all just a little bit of line so they cast not too far in front of you. And I say, the first thing you have to do is you have to find your fly on the water. Can you see it? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, second thing you have to do is when you see it, don't take your eyes off of it. Don't look at me. Don't look at the person fishing next to you. Look at the, just look at your fly, so that you'll see what happens if, you know, if a fish takes it. But then I make them put out a little more line and do it again, and then a little more line and do it again until they can get into the area where the fish are rising. This, we do this a lot of for grayling fishing, Arctic grayling fishing. Those are our real dry fly fish. And so once they have to know where to put the, so first we have the lesson in, you know, here's where the fish are going to be on the sides of these currents. And then though to say, now don't take your eyes off your fish when it drops, you know, on the water. Because people, I mean, we don't think we are, but I don't know, maybe we got a sneeze or, you know, something, but that's also, you know, is like, keep your eye on your leader, right?
Yep.
I mean, just watch your line.
Keep your eye on the leader, keep your eye on the
fly. And then the fly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you're making an imprint there, I think, too. You know, like what you said, moving it out slowly, you're
mm-hmm.
imprinting that image of that fly so that it gets mm-hmm. further away. You know what that mm-hmm. image is, and it imprints your brain for a while. You know, I think it's harder when you go to situations that you're not used to, because you don't have that print, you know, of a
yeah.
fish, whatever. If you fish for trout all the time, you might see those better than salmon or grayling.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. For each species, I think you have to learn. Because I remember when I was learning, they put a teeny tiny little atoms on the end of my leader. I couldn't see that thing for anything.
Yeah.
And so I kept saying, I can't see the fly. I can't see the fly. And finally, one of the guys was kind of annoyed with me, and he just said, well, go through my fly box and pick a fly. And I picked a great big one, and I put it on, and then I could see it, and then I started catching fish.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was getting so frustrated because I couldn't see that. And he could, you know, when he did, because he had an educated eye there,
yeah,
but
right,
I didn't.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
anyway.
Good way to put an educated eye, yeah.
Yeah.
What color lenses do you like? I mean, what do you use in Alaska?
Well, I have a couple. I have two pair, and I have one that's more of a not an orangey, but it's a kind of
amber.
Like an amber. And then I have a pair that is a little more kind of blue gray.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I take them both. But I've found that mostly the amber does it for me for almost everything.
Yeah.
So I don't have to keep, you know, changing
yeah.
glasses.
I know some people, I use a brown lens, or some call it amber, but, and then I was also, I haven't tried them, but I read about yellow lenses for cloudy days
mm-hmm.
being more helpful for the contrast, but I haven't tried those, so.
Well, I tried those once several years ago, and I hated them.
You did,
Just for, you know, for one person's opinion.
Yeah, 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 it may not.
Everything turned yellow.
Yeah.
Everything turned yellow. And
yeah.
I'm thinking, what? So, no. I don't. You might like them, but I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. So, to you, how important it is to be able to sight fish for fish? Is that, I mean,
well,
we talk about it all the time. We've been talking about seeing fish.
Seeing fish is clearly, I mean, a result of a lot of experience. I mean, the more you fish, the more you can see them. I think it's really when you can really see them, there you're using a dry fly. You're using something on the surface that you could see that's tempting the fish to come for it. And so that's why dry flies are difficult for people to use until I think they get the idea of how to make their eyes follow the fly along. How to, because the fly's, you know, not very close to you there, so you can't see where it twitches or, you know, jerks or whatever. And so you have to be able to keep it in your sight so that when a fish comes for it, you'll actually be able to see that happening. So I think in dry fly fishing, I think it's very important to see the fly. And what a lot of people don't realize is most what's most helpful is to get maybe for in the early stages one size bigger than you would ordinarily use on that fly, and then see if you can get a parachute top or like a ears that you know we use on wolves, so that you can see it. Because those two things, the fish don't see that. The fish only see the underside of it. So you see it, and it's incredibly helpful.
When I'm doing dry fly fishing, what should my presentation look like? When I make a cast out there, how should it end up? How should it land on the water? What is my goal?
Well, what you really want to do, well, first, buy my book, because it's got a couple of questions and answers there about how to do the dead drift. And people who start in fly fishing say, what the heck is a dead drift? Well, a dead drift is where your fly, which remember is imitating probably a bug, is going to float down. It's got to float down the river like the fish is used to seeing that kind of bug. And so if your fly goes too fast, the fish either can't see it or they can't, you know, process what it is. And so the idea of, you know, getting out to the fish is to do what's called the dead drift, or the drift that has, what the dead drift is the drift that looks like your fly is going down the river, and it looks like the real thing would look if it were going down the river. And that's what you have to ask yourself all the time. So then you think about, well, is the fly too big? Is my presentation wrong? But to achieve the dry fly, that dead drift, is a little hard to accomplish without a fair amount of practice, and often without somebody to help you. Because to achieve it requires that you learn mending, M-E-N-D-I-N-G. And I've looked and looked in all my career for where that line or name came from, and I still don't know. But anyway, mending means moving your fly line and your leader into such a position that they don't hinder the fly coming down or make it drag either way. So that's your presentation has to come out so that when the fly is going to land on the water, you are ready with a little flip with your tip of your rod upstream to get the line and the leader behind your fly. Now, one of the manifestos of fly fishing for everybody that you should say to yourself all the time, fly before leader, leader before line. I had that just hammered into my head when I learned how to fly fish. It comes when your fly is going down the water, it's fly before leader, leader before line, and no drag. Now, drag is when, you can see drag. It's when the fish or the line makes little squishy movements there, and you're pulling it tight. So first, that's what you have to do, is to get it so that you can get your fly going down the river correctly, and your rod tip is following it and pointing right at it as it goes down, and there's no drag or pull or anything with it. That's what your presentation should look like. Okay. And how do I accomplish it? You practice, and you practice mending, and you practice dry fly casting. Now, so as I say, get the book, and there's two chapters. There are two questions that relate to them, because you have to practice to make your hand stop in the front for the front stop on the cast so that the fly drifts down to the water. Most people just slap it down. And so the chapter that's in there talks about splat. It talks about it. And so you don't splat. Your fish and your line and your leader don't splat when you're dry fly fishing, because all you just did was scare all the fish, and your fly is going to start to drag immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Good. Good. What about landing fish? especially when you're alone. Sometimes it's kind of difficult with a 9-foot rod and 10, 12-foot leader. And what tips can you give on that and, you know, keeping the fish healthy in the whole process?
Yes, that's the whole issue there. You've got to land it, but keep it in the water while you're getting there. Well, the first thing that most people miss is you actually need to, when you're landing a fish, you actually need to pull out line off of your leader so that when your rod tip is up, you will be able to keep, there's enough line and leader that the fish will keep the fly in its mouth and stay in the water. Their head is not out of the water. That's your goal, to try to, the first step, to try to get them in. This is one that's the explanation that's in the book, too. So that you can get them up to the level, I mean, up to the beach. Now, if you've got a net, that's fine. Then you can just bend over and get the fish. Then put your elbow, raise your elbow and put your reel under your armpit. And so you hold your armpit. Don't put it down on the ground. You'll step on it, or somebody else will, or it'll go off down the river. And while you're releasing the fish correctly. And so, but it's hard to do because you don't have somebody to help you or somebody to hold on to your fly rod while you're doing it. So if you don't have a net, then what you're going to need to do is to get the fish up to the edge of the water so that you go down to the fish, go down on your hands and knees if need be, but you can be down there on your knees and just bring the fish so that it is not out of the water. It has to stay in the water. And all of it has to stay in the water. People grab it and the head comes out of the water. That's the most important part. So the whole fish needs to stay in the water. Then you have to pull out some line off of your reel to release the tension so that now you could get the fly out. Okay, and so you should have your hemostats or a pair of needle-nose pliers ready on your belt so that you can take out the fly. And then you do practice catch and release. Now, I want to make sure that everybody who's listening tonight knows that we no longer advise people to move the fish back and forth to revive them.
Mm.
That is, you no longer do that. All that does is contribute to him drowning. So The fish has just his face turned into the current, and you hold him there into the current while he revives as the current comes through his gills. So if you go back and forth, you're negating that, and you're actually contributing to his drowning. So you always hold a fish with his head completely submerged straight into the current, and then now you hold him. You can hold him, depends on what kind of fish you've got, in different ways, but hold him so that his face stays pointed into the current. Don't get a light a current as you can, because it's easier for him to revive. It's harder for him to revive in a big current. But then hold him until he actually just shoves himself right out of your hands. What some people do is to say, "Oh, his gills are moving now. He's ready to go." No, he's not. And then they say, "Oh, you know, he's wiggling, so he's ready to go." No, he's not. He's not ready to go until he decides and tells you by shoving himself out of your hands that he is revived. And now you've got a healthy fish back in the water.
Yeah, good, good. Yeah, I hadn't heard about the, not moving them. That's a good tip. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We got a question from Becky Black in Wasilla, Alaska.
Uh-huh.
Can you recommend any books or videos to watch for fly tying beginners?
Well, I'm back to the YouTube. There's really pretty good lots of beginning YouTubes. You kind of have to get around, Becky. Check out one and then check out another and look for two or three until you find one that kind of makes sense to you. And then you can do what a lot of people do, is they go and get a vise and they set it up and get some thread and a couple of hooks and try to do what the person on the YouTube is doing. And that's one way that actually a fair amount of people learn to do it. Or, again, take a class. I mean, as I say, I teach fly tying classes, and the Alaska Fly Fishers Club has some, they have a monthly fly tying gig. And so the books seem to be, to me, not as helpful as the videos because you don't understand the language and you don't understand what they're, you know, talking about, the utensils and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and there are probably another tip is, you know, don't start out with anything too complex. Try simple things first. Yeah, get the hang of and feel of things. That's always.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Do you think people really do you save money by tying your own flies, or is it more enjoyment
in
learning?
Yes, maybe.
Yes, maybe.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you start by thinking you're going to tie every fly that, you know, all these people are using, and why not? You're going to have to buy tons of material and different hooks and, you know, all of that kind of thing. So you should start, and I tell my students that we start with about 8 different flies. And with all those 8 flies, you can catch with either one, I mean, any one of them, or certain ones of them, I guess I should say, will catch a particular fish species that you might be after in Alaska. So that's what you want to do, or if you take a class, you want to get like 3 or 4 or 5, depends on how long the class is, of flies that are versatile, that you can use in different sizes and colors for different fish, like the woolly bugger. I mean, the woolly bugger is a classic streamer fly.
Yeah.
And so then, for the first couple of years, if you keep yourself to those 6 or 8 flies that you learned in your beginning class, you won't have spent a whole lot of money, and you will find that you are saving a lot of money. Because, like I teach in my class too, like you can use this same hook for these 3 flies.
Right.
Whereas, you know, a book or a video might tell you to go get a different hook for each of those flies, and now you're spending more money.
Yeah.
So
good. Question came in on the internet from John in Arvada. Asks, how do you organize your fly boxes, and how does a person avoid bringing too much stuff streamside?
Oh dear, that's my personal difficulty all the time. I've got another chapter in the book. Hopefully, people are going to be buying these books that will tell you about a couple of my difficulties in trying to figure out how to organize my fly boxes. First, I try to do it by color, and I think then I try to do it by like a streamer, like type of flies, and then I try to do it like, well, I need a few of these and a few of these and a few of these in one box. Because see, I'm guiding people, so we may fish on a river one day for trout in the morning and pink salmon in the afternoon and grayling before we go home for dinner. So I have to have a whole bunch of flies and different flies, and so right now actually what I've ended up doing is putting groups of the same fly together, and then in some cases, using smaller fly boxes. But everyone in the end really ends up with their own system. It may be the mess from hell in your fly boxes, but if it's your system and you can find something, then it's probably okay for you.
Yeah. I know, I'll plug one of our clients, Cliff Out Doors makes a lot of nice fly boxes, but he has one called the Day's Worth and the Super Day's Worth. And the idea is between the Day's Worth is just to put in there what you think you're going to use today. You know, if you're not a guide, of course. And a guide has other issues that they have to, like you said, that you have to deal with. But, you know, if you know that the mayflies are going to be out but the caddis aren't, then you don't need your caddis. Put in the mayflies. You know,
yeah, but we don't know that. So,
yeah.
Well, not. So, you know, we have to take them both. We have to, and see, that's always had been my, you know, if I took this and this hatch didn't come off, then I was like screwed. And you know, and so it probably a lot of people find best that they take one or two boxes, and they'll have like dry flies and nymphs in one box, and then streamers in the other box, and they carry just those two. So you know, you just have to try the stuff and figure it out what you like.
Experiment what works best for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What about all the other stuff? I mean, there's a lot of pockets on these vests. Do we need to fill them all up?
Well, actually, yes. There's many places on the Internet that, that's why there's so many boxes, right? But there's plenty of places on the Internet that will give you, and I've got one of those chapters in the book, too, what are kind of the essentials. Because a lot of people take, there's a lot of gadgets. This is a world of gadgets. I have a friend whose husband died few years ago, and she asked me to come over and help me go through her fly fishing stuff because she doesn't fish. Her husband had more gadgets than you could ever, ever imagine. Every single gadget that was ever created, he had, and he didn't need 3/4 of them. Some people need. You always need sunscreen. You always need your fishing license. Those are the kinds of things that you have to be sure are in there, you know, but I think a lot of people don't really stop and think, you know, do I really need this? In this case, I would say read the book. it's got some ideas and tips and stuff for you, because different people are fishing in different places for different fish, and all of that may require some different kinds of things for your vest.
Yeah, some different kinds of gadgets. Okay. Yeah. Let's see here. What do we got for questions? When fishing a new area, do you recommend a guide? If so, you know, what questions do you need to ask them when you're hiring them? If you're calling on the phone or, you know, you're walking into a shop, what do you want to ask?
Well, number one, if you're fishing in a new area where you've never fished, absolutely I recommend a guide. Now, that doesn't have to be a full day or a 5-day trip for a couple of $1,000s. No, it can be try to do at least a half a day in the area that you're going to be fishing, and use it as a learning experience. Watch what kind of flies the guides use. Watch how they tell you to cast, where they tell you to cast. What kind of stripping they're using, you know, all of that kind of thing. So make it half a day of hurry-up learning, and so that you can do some of what they do. But then when you have questions for them, yeah, that's first is, you know, do you offer a half a day? And if you can afford a full day, do a full day. But at least do one of those. Don't try to go out on water you've never fished and think you're going to have a really good day, because you're really not. But then you want to know what he or she charges for a half a day or a full day, and then you have to decide kind of what you want to do, and make very clear if you're hiring them for you or if you're going to be hiring into like a boat that's got three other people that's drifting down the Kenai River in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, those are things that you need to ask. And also, people always forget when they go to a new area, you got to have a fishing license. So be sure that you and your guide know that you've got a fishing license.
Yeah.
Because every guide will tell you, if you get busted, we get busted.
Yeah, yeah.
So
okay, a couple more questions. We've kind of run out of time. Maybe we can kind of whip through these as fast as
okay.
we can here. Jim Bissell in Cincinnati says, I'm too competitive to be complacent, but don't get on the water as much as I'd like. What are some steps I can take to stay knowledgeable and keep the rust off?
Well, I think it's go practice, go fish in a lake, even though you're not maybe, you know, used to a lot of fishing in lakes. I mean, do it. Just do it whatever you can. The knowledgeable part, you know, we've got plenty of stuff on the internet, and there's lots of good books for, you know, all kinds of new techniques and all of that, you know, and that's easy to buy and to do. But it's more, I think, keep the rust off, is just going and doing it. Even if you only do it for half an hour, or you take the next-door neighbor's kid to a pond, just get out on the water and do it.
I find, a lot of times looking at some of the videos on YouTube and stuff can be motivating, too. You watch something and you go, geez, I'm going to go out and do that. I'm going to go try that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think... And those don't cost you anything, and, you know, it's great. Okay, a couple of these questions are similar from Bob in Flushing, Michigan, and Roger in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Bob asks, what's your biggest breakthrough, Pudge? Conquering tailing loops, learning to present a fly most effectively? What is it?
I have two, guys, Bob and Roger and everybody else. I have two. One was I had two surgeries on the elbow of my casting arm, and my first one was when I relearned the double haul. When I had those surgeries, I somehow, in my inner self, lost the ability to make a double haul. I don't know why. And then all of a sudden, one day I did. But the other one is mastering Czechoslovakian nymphing. Mm. I am in love with Czechoslovakian nymphing. I'm one of the few people who teaches it up here, too. So those are the two breakthroughs.
Mm, interesting. Not what I would have expected.
Nope, not what you have expected.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, no. If you haven't thought about or learned or found somebody maybe to teach you about Czechoslovakian nymphing. Well, I love nymphing, and not a lot of people in Alaska do nymphing until I show them the Czechoslovakian nymphing.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So those are my two.
Yeah, Roger Campbell in Cheyenne, Wyoming, he said, this is a little bit different, so I shouldn't have kind of lumped them together, but he said there may be more than one thing that moves one from a rookie to novice to pro. If so, what one thing among many is the most important? That's a little bit different question, so maybe you can address that.
Okay, well, I wouldn't necessarily call them, you know, milestones, maybe, but I think the day you get confident and think, oh, I've got the midriff down now, I know it, is a milestone, just because that's something that's important and that you need to do. And but just a milepost might be you've always wanted to go fish redfish in Texas, and you did it, and so that's a milestone. So I think we all need milestones like that, but in from different things. Learn a new technique. Go a new place. Try a new fly. And I think every single one of those things is a milestone.
Yeah. A couple of just specific questions on grayling, because you're such a grayling pro. We got Ramona in Fairbanks. What's your most productive nymphs for Arctic grayling?
Czechoslovakian nymphs.
Okay.
They
and
are.
Becky Black and Wasilla says, what's one of your favorite places to fish for grayling in Alaska?
Well, there's a lot of rivers in the far north, up at Kotzebue, Nome, that have amazing grayling fishing. And I love when I'm able to get up there to go. So those are some of my favorite
places. Which is
a
long way from Wasilla, right?
Yes, exactly. And Anchorage, too. Way up there.
Too.
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Okay, here's the final question for you.
Okay.
George Kelly in Florida, he says, my question is not directly related to improving my skills, but rather about improving my lot in life. Could you direct me to a young lady, late 50s, early 60s, who can back up a boat trailer, tie some of the most popular flies, throw a cast, net, and rustle up a decent meatloaf?
Sorry, George.
Sorry, George.
You're asking the wrong person, darn it. I could do maybe a young lady in for one or the other of your requirements, but not them all. Sorry.
Not them all. Keep looking, George.
Keep looking, George.
Yeah. And the one thing you didn't specify here, George, is, you know, whether she needed to be able to fish salt or fresh or You know,
yeah.
You weren't species specific. I mean, you got to be more specific here if you really want the
exactly.
Right one.
Exactly. So, and besides, yeah, throw a cast net. That's what you said, throw a cast net, not just throw a cast. So, yeah. So you have to refine your requirements a little.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, let's got to call it a night here. We're out of time. So I just wanted to let everybody know that we're going to wrap it up here, give away a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. We're going to give away a subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, as well as a copy of Pudge's most recent book, Rookie No More, courtesy of Pudge Kleinkopf. So stick with us here just another minute or two. We're going to give those things away, and then we'll call it a night. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. Chuitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chuitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial and sport subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild the salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chuitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. So it's time to stop the Chuitna strip mine. If you'd like more information on how you can help, visit www.chuitna.org, that's C-H-U-I-T-N-A.org, chuitna.org, and see how you can help out with that great cause. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link, leave your comments, and we'd really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away a few prizes. Let me just jump into my database here, and we'll give away the Federation of Fly Fishers one-year membership first. And we've got... And if you're not familiar with them, go check them out, fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And as Pudge said earlier, international organization, and one that's great in conservation and so forth, great one to support. Okay. Let's get the database going here. Okay, so our winner here is Steve Bodenstav, Stephen Bodenstav in Illinois. So let me just jot this down. Congratulations, Stephen, and just got yourself a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Okay, second one is one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And let's see who our winner is. Tom Berry in Ohio. So Tom Berry in Ohio, congratulations. Gentlemen, I will be sending you out an email asking for information from you, and then we'll get those prizes started for you. Now we'll give away a copy of Pudge's book, and Rookie No More, The Fly Fishing Novice Gets Guidance from a Pro. And as you see, there are many unanswered questions we didn't get to tonight, so be sure to pick up Pudge's book if you don't win, which most of you won't. So there's only one winner. So anyway, check it out at her website, which is, again, womensflyfishing.net. Correct, Pudge?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Okay, so one of the things that Pudge's mentor told her way back when and has become something that she's chosen to follow for life here and teach others. She was given a recommendation. And what was that recommendation for catching more fish?
Watch your mind.
No, you're not supposed to answer, Pudge.
I'm sorry. I thought
okay,
you were
okay, now
I've got to
come up with another question.
Sorry.
That doesn't count.
Oh, dear, I'm sorry.
Nix on that. Okay, so if you type that in, forget it. You're not going to win. Okay, now I have to come up with another question. Okay, name the two breakthroughs that Pudge had. Name the two major breakthroughs that Pudge had in her fly fishing career that really kind of moved her forward. So what are those two things? Don't answer, Pudge.
I won't. my lips are sealed.
Okay. Sorry, Doug, you answered the first question. Sorry, Victor, you answered the first question. I got all these answers coming in there now. So you guys got to switch over to the new question, which has two answers. Okay, I got to get rid of all these answers coming in here. Okay. Boy, we got a lot of people answering. Oh, I think we got it here. The answer is double haul after surgery and Chuck nymphing.
That's right.
Okay, that's Jake Jones in Yukon, Oklahoma. So, Jake, congratulations. And, Jake, send me over there in the same text box, send me your address. I've got your name, I've got your email address. Just need your shipping address so that Fudge can get out a book to you directly. So, thanks for playing. Sorry, people that had all those great answers on the first one, but actually, this is probably a harder question, so it's well-deserved. And thanks for playing, everybody, tonight, and congratulations. Well, Pudge, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. It's always great having you on board, and always like to enjoy the knowledge that you have to share, and you're always so sharing, so I appreciate you being on the show.
Well, I thank you very much for inviting me. Hope you'll invite me again, even though I did screw up at the end.
No problem. No problem. Well, our next broadcast will be December 7th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And that show, I'm going to interview Tom Boyd. And our topic for the show will be the state of the char. Tom not only fly fishes, he researches, takes DNA samples, tags, and learns everything he can about the fish he targets. So join us to find out what he's learned about the char, including Arctic char, Dolly Varden, brook trout, and bull trout, both from the Pacific coast to the eastern seaboard, both the anadromous and landlocked fish. He's going to talk about all that stuff. He's like a walking encyclopedia. So tune in for that, and you'll learn more. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Watermaster, Front Range Angler, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to sign up to receive our announcements on our front page there. Just sign up, put in your name, your email address, and we'll keep you informed about all the future shows. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing. Well,